I cannot think of a better song to have done before Dr. Clark comes. He has been at the helm of North Carolina Wesleyan College for almost 2 years, and he has an unwavering faith and an unwavering commitment to see North Carolina Wesleyan College be the Christian college that God intended for it to be. And I admire your unwavering character as well. God bless. Would you come?
Let's do something out of the ordinary.
Thank you, John, and it's a privilege to be here this morning in Manio. You know, you don't very often get to share a pulpit with somebody like John Check, so, you know, it's a great honor for me. And thank you for Bill and Suzanne Godley. I stayed at their bed and breakfast last night, okay? But I stayed with Wayne and Audrey Sears, so those of you that know Wayne know that that could have gone either way. Wayne kept me up way past my bedtime. We were up till the wee hours of the night. I didn't get to bed till almost 10 o'clock last night. So that was something else. But I also have my wife with me, Suzanne. We've been married almost 25 years. She is the author of 2 books, and if you want a copy of one of her books, she'll have some after the service today. She wrote a book a few years ago about a child that we lost, Zachary. So she wrote that, Cry Out to Jesus, and it was published about 7 or 8 years ago, and she's published her 2nd book. So we have an author here with us today, okay? So, you know, thank you, Suzanne, for coming and supporting me, and if you're interested in her book, let her know. It's Blessed Be the Tide is the name of the book. I also want to let you know, at North Carolina Wesleyan College this summer, we're starting a youth theological institute. It's for high school sophomores or juniors that are interested in going into the Christian Ministries major. And it's a week-long camp on our campus this summer, and this summer is free. So if you're interested in that, let John know. He's got more information. So I just wanted to also do a commercial on that. You know, John said I was the president of North Carolina Wesleyan College, and that doesn't really sound like a big deal. But I can tell you it is when I tell you a little bit about myself. I'm a first-generation college student. I was raised on a tobacco farm in eastern North Carolina, where common sense and logic dominated everything that we did. And political correctness was non-existent. If you did something stupid, you were called out on it. And that's the kind of environment I was raised in. I'm ultra-conservative, and I'm proud of it. I'm a businessman, and I worked for a company called MBM for 24 years, and we grew that company from about $100 million to $7 billion, and it was bought by Warren Buffett. So I'm a businessman at heart, and I'm not ashamed of that. I'm proud of that. I got my MBA from Campbell University, a good Baptist school. Got my PhD at night, working on this thing called a computer, which, believe it or not, on college campuses, oftentimes is frowned on. I'm married to a woman for 24 years, almost 25 years. All these things don't get a, when you're on a college campus, you're in a minority, okay? You're in a minority. So God can take somebody like me and put me in a very liberal place like a college campus, and I can survive there and I can thrive there. I have about 60 faculty people, 60 there, and 20 of them think I can walk on water, and I can't. 20 of them don't care whether I can or not. 20 of them wish I would try and drown. Okay? So that's kind of the way it is a lot of times when you're on a college campus, but, you know, God's in control. You know, he's always in control. I've got a special attachment to Manio also. I was a resident here, actually over in Nag's Head. When I graduated from North Carolina Wesleyan College in the spring of 1982, I didn't have a job. I went home for about 2 days, and that's about all you need in Zebulun to know that there's not much happening. So I decided to do something that everybody always talks about doing. I was going to come to the beach and work for the summer and find myself. You know how that goes. So I came down here without a job. I had a 1975 Pontiac Firebird, no place to stay, a little bit of graduation money. And I started going up and down the beach looking for a job. No jobs to be found. I was sleeping in my car at night. Finally, I got to milepost 12, and there was a seafood restaurant there called The Wharf. Anybody familiar with The Wharf, remember that Mr. Randy Culp used to run that restaurant. He was a great businessman. I knocked on his door, and I said, "Mr. Culp, I need a job, mister." And he said, "Well, you know, can you wait on tables?" Well, he didn't ask the question in the right way. You know, I can wait on tables. I just had never done it officially. I said, "Yes, sir, I can wait on tables." I mean, I'd waited on them at family reunions and whatnot, so I felt like I was qualified. So he said, "You're hired." And he said, "You know, we opened the restaurant Memorial Weekend." I said, "Mr. Culp, that's 2 weeks away. I need a job." He said, "Can you paint?" Of course I can paint. I was raised on a farm. So he gave me a paint and a paintbrush, and I painted that entire restaurant. And after about a week, I was finished. And he said, "Well, I'm going to go on vacation before the restaurant opens. You're welcome to stay here and do whatever." Well, I'd met this gentleman, Rick. I don't know Rick's last name. Rick was in the Marines. And I said, Rick, what are you going to do from now until next week? He said, you're going to almost fall out of your seat when I tell you what he said. He said, "I am going to walk to the lighthouse." I said, "You mean the big tall one down at Cape Hatteras?" He said, "Yes, there'll be all kinds of fun and exciting things happening on the beach between here and there for two 22-year-olds. He said, "I have a surfboard. I'll teach you to surf. It's only about 80 or 90 miles. I've got a couple of tents from the military. You can have one, and we'll walk to the lighthouse, walk all the way down there." I thought, you know, at 22 years old, adventure was the key word of life. So I said, "Absolutely." So we started walking, and we walked on the beach, and we surfed. He surfed, and I looked like a fool. We had a great time. We walked all the way down there. We ate in little, you know, variety pickups or whatever, beanie weenies or nabs or whatever. And it didn't take me long. I mean, I was raised on a farm. After about 600 or 800 yards of walking on that sand, I said, "Rick, you know, have you thought about how we're going to get back once we get down there?" And he didn't say anything. So anyway, we walked all the way down there. It was one of my greatest accomplishments in life. Some people say it's one of the more foolish things I've ever done. I wouldn't recommend it, by the way. Sand is sand. The ocean, you know, that whole notion of sleeping by the ocean, that, you know, that's okay for maybe one night. But anyway, we get down to the lighthouse. We go up in the lighthouse, and we start hitchhiking back to the wharf. Well, after about a mile or so, this old fisherman, he picks us up in a pickup truck. He's got a dog in the front with him. The dog didn't smell very good at all. So he put the dog in the back and Rick and I in the front. Well, after about 3 or 4 miles, he stopped and he said, I'll tell you what, he said, I'll be honest with you. You guys need to get in the back. I'm going to put the dog back up here. We stunk so bad that we got overrode by the dog. He put the dog back in the front. So anyway, that was my start to my life here at Nag's Head. I had a wonderful summer. That summer I worked with Randy Culp, and he was a great guy to work for. So anyway, I love this place. We try to come down at least once a summer and spend a little time here, and it is a wonderful place. And, you know, being on a college campus is unusual. Like I said, you know, being a first-generation college student, I got introduced in biology class one time to a concept called evolution. And I had two college friends, Waverly, Christopher, and Carson Saunders, who came to join me at Nag's Head. And we were in a biology class together, and the teacher was talking about evolution. And Carson and Waverly didn't particularly like his concept on the way they came about, and I didn't like it either. So one weekend, they went into the classroom, and on the chalkboard, they wrote, "Evolution is a big bunch of bull," you know, and they filled it in. Well, Dr. Bob Walton walked in the room, and he looked at the board, and he said, he looked at us three, because he knew those two, not me. I was not involved in this. I'm just an innocent bystander. He knew those other two had probably been up to something. So he looked right at Waverly, and he said, "What in the world is that? What is that?" And Waverly said, "Well, it's real easy. You see that window over there over the weekend, it got opened, and the wind started swirling around, and it just kind of, the chalk dust in the tray, and the wind swirled around, and it just kind of happened. It's what you call evolution. That did not go over very well. We got asked to leave the class, and it was, you know, I'm just an innocent bystander. But anyway, college campuses are unique. They're wonderful places. I'm enjoying my presidency. It's going to be a lot of fun. But I'm here today to talk to you about stewardship. It's a concept that's near and dear to my heart. And while I'm getting ready to talk here, if you would turn in your Bibles to Genesis 39, it's the story of Joseph. But first of all, what is stewardship? What is that? It's a word that's commonly used. And according to the dictionary, it's an individual's responsibility to manage his life and property with proper regard to the rights of others. That's what stewardship is. Most people never get it right. Most people in life never get stewardship right, and they suffer their whole life because of that. They never get stewardship right. There is an example in the Bible, Joseph, my second favorite Bible character after Jesus. He got it right. He nailed stewardship. He absolutely nailed it. Joseph was Jacob's son in the Old Testament. You know the story probably. He's the first Joseph ever recorded. There was never another Joseph before him, according to archaeology. Now, one out of every 100 people you meet is named Joseph. If there's 100 people in a room, there's probably a Joe or a Joseph. Do we have a Joseph here today? Or a Joe? We got one. Got about 100 people. The average holds. Thank you, Joe. That was not planned. Joseph comes from the root word deliverer, which is the same Hebrew root word that Jesus came from, deliverer. So Joseph is a very unique story. He's the 11th son of Jacob. He became his favorite son, if you know the story. Jacob gave him a coat of many colors. That coat of many colors has been produced on Broadway. There's movies about it. There's books written about it. But Joseph was the apple of Jacob's eye. Jacob loved Joseph. He loved him more than any of his other sons. Well, that irritated the other 10 older sons. It really irritated him because in Jewish culture, if you were the firstborn, you had a leg up for the rest of your life. You had it made for the rest of your life. And here comes number 11, and he steals everything, all the favor, all the glory. So the other 10 brothers did not like Joseph. Well, one day, Jacob sent Joseph out to find his brothers. And here he goes walking with that coat of many colors. Here he goes walking through Canaan for 35 miles to find his brothers. When they saw him coming, they were so irritated, they said, "Let's kill that rascal. Let's kill him right now and be done with him." But they threw him in a pit, and then they sold him into slavery. So that's where the story that I'm going to tell, or the sermon I'm going to preach today, starts. And I know some of you are rolling your eyes. You mean he just got started? I'm Baptist. You know, we stay out in the water longer, but we don't stay in church longer, okay? So don't worry. We're going to be okay. We're going to get out on time. So if you look at the scripture there, and I'll read it for you here real quick. It said, now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him for the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything that he did, Joseph found favor in the eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of the household and entrusted his care to everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. Now that's really an incredible story if you think about it. Verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered. He was a slave. How does a slave prosper? How do you prosper if you were a slave? He had nothing. He didn't have anything. He was a slave. Technically, he didn't even own the clothes on his back. So how could he prosper? How is that possible? How in the world can somebody in that environment, he was shackled on the way to Egypt. He walked 350 miles through the Sur Desert, and many people died making that trip. He went from Dothan all the way to Memphis, Egypt. That's 350 miles, and he was wearing shackles. When he got there, he was bought, and then the Bible said that he prospered. How in the world does somebody like that prosper? He's in a foreign land. He's speaking a different language. He has been raising goats and cows and sheep, and now he's in one of the most sophisticated societies that's ever been, very mathematically oriented. That's a mouthful for a country boy. Mathematically oriented culture. How in the world did he not only survive but thrive? How did he do that? How in the world did he do that? Well, he had something that we all want. We all want. It's the second most important thing that you can have. It's the second most important thing. The most important thing you can have is salvation. That's the most important thing. Then eternity is taken care of. But you have this other little issue called life. What am I going to do? What's going to happen between now and then? So what do you need? Well, he had it. Joseph had it. It's called the favor of God. Joseph had the favor of God. How in the world did he get the favor of God? How did he get it? That's the key question. And then over and beyond that, how did he keep it? How do you get the favor of God, and then how do you keep it? Joseph was highly favored. He was highly favored. But some people become highly favored, and then they fall out of favor. So how did he get it and how did he keep it? He was promoted 7 times. If you read the whole story very carefully, he was promoted 7 times. The first time is he was his father's favorite. Now that was very difficult in Jewish society to override 10 other boys in front of you and become the favorite. That's not easy, but he did it. He became a choice slave on the way to Egypt, according to Jewish tradition, and he was in the front of the line to be sold to the best place he could be sold to, which was Potiphar. And then he went from a common slave to Potiphar to the head gardener very quickly. He was over the outside. Then he was put over the entire state. Now Potiphar's estate has been found. Potiphar was a very wealthy man. So Joseph just happened to be put where he could really thrive and be noticed. So the next promotion he had was when he was in prison. He was promoted in prison. I've never heard of another story of somebody being promoted while in prison. I mean, how in the world does that happen? You know, usually you just kind of sit there and rot, but Joseph was promoted. Then he went to become the second in command in Egypt, and that was the greatest civilization at that time. How in the world did he do that? And, of course, his final promotion, which is all our final promotions, was to heaven. When that's your last promotion. My obituary can be very simple. Dewey Clark died, was promoted to heaven. End it right there, period. Don't need to say anything else. So how did he do that? How did a shepherd boy that had counted sheep, how did he gain that favor and keep it and be promoted like that? I mean, he was 18 when all this story started. He spent 12 years in basically living hell. He was a slave, and then he went to prison. How did he do that? How did he gain the favor, and how did he keep it? Well, I spent 3 years of my life researching that. 3 years. I wrote my dissertation on the leadership lessons of Joseph. It was extremely frowned upon when I announced that I wanted to write a book on that or a dissertation on it. I was going to Argosy University. It's a secular school. There's Christians there. But when I told them I wanted to write on Joseph, because my PhD is in management, and leadership is a key part of management. And to me, Joseph is one of the greatest leaders there's ever been. But it was frowned on. But it was finally approved, and I spent 3 years researching Joseph. I made myself a little spreadsheet. I read that story, Genesis 37 through 50. I read it 512 times. I read it 512 days in a row. I read 24 books about Joseph, over 100 commentaries. I bought a Bible software, and I dug in at how did he do that? How did he gain that favor, and how did he keep it? Well, I've got 12 things he did. Now, again, I'm Baptist. I'm not going to keep you a long time. I'm only going to talk about one of them today, and it's stewardship. So Joseph understood Three things about stewardship. That was how he did it. That was how he gained the favor of God and how he kept it. One thing that he did was stewardship. He understood it better than most people. The first part of stewardship that Joseph understood is that I'm a steward of me. I steward me. I belong to God. Everything that I am is God's. When I become a child of God, I've given myself to God. I'm no longer mine. I've given myself to God. I've learned to accept the circumstances of my life, but I belong to God. I've given myself and everything I am to God. You know, I was born in a very poor environment. As I said earlier, they don't teach common sense is what they told me, so don't go to college. But I wanted to improve myself. I wanted to better myself. I understood even at an early age somehow or another that I belong to God. I'm God's, and everything I do is for God. So Joseph goes through 30 years of living hell, and he only complains one time. He understands that he's working for God. That's how he was able to prosper when he was a slave. Everything he did it for God. You know, Abraham Lincoln said that character is what you're doing when nobody else is looking. Are you still doing the right thing when nobody else is looking and nobody else could ever find out? Joseph understood that. Joseph understood that God was looking over his shoulder, that God is micromanaging his life, and he was okay with that. God was looking over his shoulder. Joseph was away from his family. Everybody that cared about him thought he was dead. There was nobody praying for Joseph. You know, it's a wonderful thing to have a church family. And I am notorious. People ask me, how can I help you, Dewey? How can I help you with that crazy college you have? And I say, pray for me. Pray for me. But who was praying for Joseph? His daddy thought he was dead. His brothers hated him and wanted to kill him. They weren't praying for him. Who was praying for Joseph? Nobody. He was going alone. He was praying for himself. Sometimes in life, when God wants to teach you a lesson, he puts you in a place where you are alone, and you still have to rely on him, even though there's nobody else praying for you. It's great to have people praying for you. I encourage it, but sometimes you have to go it alone. Joseph went it alone. He went through an extreme trial. God wanted him in Egypt. God wanted Joseph in Egypt, so he didn't tell him to go. He took him there. Sometimes God takes you places. Joseph understood the first part of stewardship was to give yourself to God. Give your time, your talent. Everything belongs to God. Everything that you have is really God. So Joseph understood that. He knew that he was working for God. He didn't concern himself with pleasing man. He felt like he was working for God. And that's a real release. When you get to that point in your life, that is a very, very relief. A release. Joseph understood the principle, your life is God's gift to you, and what you do with it is your gift back to God. We're really borrowing ourselves when you look at it. We belong to God. Everything about us belongs to God. So be a good steward of yourself. Give yourself fully to God, and he will do something miraculous. Joseph is an example of what God can do with somebody who will give themselves completely to him. We all have enormous potential, and Joseph is an example of what can happen when you give yourself to God. The second thing that Joseph was a steward of was his things, the things that he owned. We all have things. We're accumulating things. Everybody wants another boat, another house, another car. We're accumulating things our whole life. My friend Walt Wiley said, we buy things for people we do not like with money we do not have. We're all accumulating a bunch of stuff, things. We're piling it up. You can't take it with you. Walt Wiley said, if you really think it's yours, put your name on it, have your family put it in the casket with you, close the casket up, come back and open it a year later, and if it's gone, it was yours. If it's not gone, then it's God's. It was really God's the whole time. So these things that we have are not ours. They're God's. Turn loose of them. They're not really yours. They're here for a very, very short time. Joseph had a real lesson in this because he didn't own anything until he was 30 years old. He didn't own anything. And he went in one day's time to being a slave, if you know the rest of the story. He went from being a slave to the second in command in all of Egypt. Jewish history tells us that he became a very, very wealthy man. I mean, extremely wealthy man. He would have the equivalent of Bill Gates' money today. That's how rich Joseph was when he died, if you put it in today's terms. So he understood that things were not important and they were not really his. And see what he ended up with. He ended up with a whole lot of things. But they belonged to God to be used for his glory. And it's more than sharing. It's turning loose. It's giving. Sharing is when you let somebody use it and then you get it back. Being a steward is when you just turn it loose. Just turn it loose. These things that we have are really a loan from God to us to use for his glory and to his benefit. Again, Joseph was 30 years old and he didn't own a single thing. He was a convicted felon in prison in a foreign land and didn't own a thing. And he became the second richest man in all of Egypt. So don't get hung up on your things. Don't treat them like they're yours. Treat them like they're God's. The third thing that Joseph was a steward of was his occupation. What he did for a living. He wanted to glorify God in everything that he did. God made us all different. We're all different. Everybody's different. We have different voices. You have a unique fingerprint. Your DNA is unique. Your eyeball is unique. We're all unique. There have been over 130 billion people from Adam until now. Over 130 billion people. No two have been the same. There's not any. There's never two the same. The fingerprints are unique. And if God went to that level of detail with you and uniqueness with you, with a fingerprint, he certainly had a blueprint for you to follow for your life and had a unique purpose for you. So we're all different, and Joseph understood that. God made him for a purpose. So if you stay in God's will, you'll live up to your potential. Here's a great example of what God can do with someone that's always in his will. Enormous potential. It's the safest, most secure place that you can be. You're in training every day for your mission. Once you've accepted Christ, well, before you accept Christ, God's just trying to draw you to him. After that, every day, you're in training for what God wants you to do. It never ends until the day you die. Retirement isn't really a biblical principle as far as I can tell. I mean, I think it may mention it in the Bible maybe one time. But men struggle with this occupation. They struggle with their thing. I know I did. When I was at MBM and we grew that company from $100 million to $7 billion and Warren Buffett bought us, you know, that was me. That was MBM was me. And I probably hung on that too tight. But you got to let it go and give it to God. You got to envision that you're working for God, not for man. I'm not working for a company. I'm not working for an individual. I'm working for God. And when you do that, then there's a real release in that too. Joseph never worried about his career. He was more concerned with pleasing God. And God kept promoting him every time. He was promoted 7 times, as I said earlier. God may put you where you are, and when you accept that and embrace that, he'll promote you. Joseph was always ready for that next promotion. And I've been wondering and researching about this too. A lot of people say that Joseph was a born leader. So the question is, are leaders born or are they made? Was Joseph made that way? Natural born leaders, God-given ability. So are leaders born or are they made? Well, I spent 3 years researching and wondering about that and reading everything I could, and the answer is yes, leaders are born. The Bible plainly tells us that if we're honoring to God, that he'll bless our descendants. He'll bless our descendants. So Joseph was blessed at birth because of his descendants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He had a measure of leadership and blessing that he was born with, and then God developed him. So the answer to that question, are leaders born or made? The answer is yes, both. Some people are born with more charisma, more wherewithal than other people, and Joseph was certainly one of them. But then God took that and he molded him into something very, very special for his glory. So Joseph was the perfect steward. In closing, he didn't view his life as his own because he was the perfect steward. Joseph did not view his things as his because he was the perfect steward. He did not view his thing or his occupation or his career is his because he was the perfect steward. There are 3,237 people mentioned in the Bible by name. 3,237. You know, I've wondered why. Why did God put so many people in the Bible? It's basically a story about people is what it is. Why did he do that? Why did God do that? Why is your way to salvation through God that became man? I think it's because God knows that we can relate to people. We can relate to people. You can relate to people. There's value in human biography. And there's somebody in the Bible that you can relate to. We all have to relate and reconcile with Jesus. But there's another somebody in the Bible that you need to find and grab hold of the way I did Joseph. It really taught me a lot of lessons. At times, when I was becoming president of North Carolina Wesleyan College, there was some controversy involved in that. And I felt like I was living part of Joseph's life. And having studied it and dug into it, it helped me get through that trying time. So there's somebody in the Bible for you. And I challenge you to find that person and learn as much as you can about that person because God put them there for a reason. So lastly, and most important, how do I become a good steward? How do I do that? Number one is to know God. Joseph knew God. He didn't have to say, God, this is Joseph. When he called out to God, God knew who he was. He had a personal relationship with him. He knew him. He had a spiritual attachment with him. Number two, trust God. He's got a plan for you individually. You're not going to have to introduce yourself to God when you get to heaven. I promise you that. You know, I have a habit when I meet somebody, I just stick my hand out and shake their hand. And God, you're not going to have to do that with God. He's going to know who you are. He's going to hug you. He's going to know who you are. So trust God. Lastly, you know, please God by practicing stewardship. You know, stewards never say, I did it. Stewards never say that I worked hard and that's why I'm where I'm at. Stewards never say I'm better than anybody else. Stewards never say I deserved it. We don't deserve anything really but God's judgment. So stewardship is very important, is something that I hope you'll practice, and I hope you'll take that to heart. And thank you for allowing me to speak today.